You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. Of course, this is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this week. There is a lot to get to. Our panel today includes Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Rebecca Boone, the Associated Press supervisory correspondent in the Boise Bureau, and Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Ed News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
All right, let's talk first about what's going on with the pandemic. The southern part of Idaho went back into crisis standards of care earlier this week. So Audrey, update us on where we are with all of this right now.
Oh, it's not good. So we went into crisis standards of care last fall for 2 months, and that was largely due to staffing predominantly in the ICUs. This time it's a little bit more complicated. Hospitals are dealing with staff being out sick, which might remind people of 2020. with staff out sick or with in quarantine with children or anything like that, as well as a blood shortage, which is happening across the nation, as well as long-term care facilities dealing with their own staffing issues and unable to admit patients who, for example, need rehabilitation, so they're not ready to go home yet, but they also don't need to be staying in the hospital, and they are right now. So we've got we're back to a situation where patients are being boarded in the emergency rooms. And it's so far, you know, it was St. Alphonsus that requested the ability to go into crisis standards of care. As before, it does not mean that every hospital in the state is in crisis standards for everything all the time. It really just is allowing them to make those decisions if they need to. And what that means is longer wait times for healthcare, and you may not get the care that you're used to. So,
and with that, Rebecca, part of the issue we know is, as Audrey mentioned, yes, staffing, but there's a major blood supply shortage. Can you talk a little bit more in depth about that?
Sure. And that has also been caused by this surge, but it's not because, it's because of the experiences that all businesses are having right now, right? There's a lot of employees out sick. So the people who would be working at the Red Cross or at these other places are out sick. Businesses that might've had blood drives have canceled them. And there's, you know, there's been weather that's kind of impacted across the country, you know, normal travel routes where they ship this blood product. And so, as we entered crisis standards of care, the Department of Health and Welfare also said, hey, we need people to donate blood because a lot of our hospitals are now having to implement blood conservation strategies. They said some hospitals have gotten down to as low as one unit of blood before they get their supply replenished. That's a problem because especially if you're, you know, you get a trauma patient coming in or you have a woman who has complications during childbirth, or something like that, you're going to need a lot of blood on hand to be able to treat those people and keep them stable and keep them alive. So the state department has actually created a critical blood supply task force now. They're trying to better understand the blood shortage in Idaho and figure out how best to help hospitals sort of share this limited supply of blood across the state. They're also asking people to donate as much as, you know, if you can go and donate blood, Department of Health and Welfare is saying, please do that. You can do that with the Red Cross. In Northern Idaho, you can do it with America's Blood Centers or platelets. People, you know, there's also a need for platelets right now.
Okay. So if you can donate right now. And then in the middle of this surge, in fact, as we mentioned, going back into crisis standards of care earlier this week, Kevin and Scott, you can both weigh in on this. The West Ada School District makes a pretty controversial decision. Scott, why don't you set this up? And then Kevin, you can talk about this as well, I know.
Sure. This was kind of a bizarre decision. The West Ada School Board voted 3-2 to stop sending notifications to families when their child may have been exposed to a student with COVID-19 in in their classroom. The trustees who supported getting rid of the notifications said that they were just feeding into people's fears. And in a bizarre twist of logic, they said, you know, the families are receiving so many notifications that it's just causing stress. Well, they're receiving so many notifications because there are so many COVID cases going on. It seems like kind of a bizarre time to pull back on those notifications rather than informing families when their child has been exposed. And the school board members who voted against getting rid of the notifications, they said that, you know, families at home might have vulnerable, medically vulnerable people living with them, or elderly or young children. And so it was a bad time to get rid of those notifications. And it's worth noting that West Ada stopped contact tracing several months ago, and they also got rid of their mask. They made masks optional after Thanksgiving break. So clearly there's evidence that COVID is spreading and happening. Instead of informing parents, the West Ada School District is now not informing families if their child has been exposed to someone with COVID.
And Kevin, go ahead.
No, Jim, I kind of felt like from our coverage that the trustees who voted for this change are basing it on the premise and maybe the hope that this variant is going to flame itself out fairly quickly, that it's going to be a big surge that goes away. And that may be more than a hope. I mean, we're seeing signs of that elsewhere in the country, that this surge seems to be a big spike that may not last long. But the fact of the matter is, we're not the Northeast. We just got into this Omicron surge just a few weeks ago, and we're still in the thick of it. If you look at the statewide case numbers and the huge backlog of untracked cases that are still being processed, we're right in the heart of this thing.
And I think the other point too is, well, why not, if somebody doesn't want to get these notifications, why don't they just opt out of it, or, you know, send it to their spam folder or whatever? But families who do want to get this information, they should still be allowed to be informed. Isn't it better to over inform than under communicate?
I think you can unsubscribe from emails. I think that's a 2022 technology that just came on. So
you think?
Well taken, right. Scott.
Well, and Kevin, and then you have the Caldwell School District that at the same time that West Ada makes this decision, the Caldwell School District implements masks again.
Right. I mean, you know, welcome to our world as we cover this thing, because, you know, every district, it seems, is having a different experience and having a different response to it, you know. And, you know, I think it goes also to some of the issues that we're talking about here in terms of the case numbers. There's really no consistency either as we try to figure out, you know, what's happening in terms of cases in West Ada versus Boise versus Nampa. You know, everybody kind of tracks it a little bit differently. And by extension, everybody seems to be responding to this surge a little bit differently in terms of policy and protocol.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of policy and protocol, Scott, some interesting news coming out of Gonzaga University in regards to probably one of the university's most well-known alums, John Stockton.
Yeah, for those who follow sports, or you should say for people who don't follow sports, John Stockton is a legendary basketball player, Hall of Famer, played for the Utah Jazz, and is an alum of Gonzaga University, and probably, like you said, is their most famous alum. His number is retired at Gonzaga. He lives in Spokane, and he has season tickets to the Gonzaga basketball games. Well, he apparently was violating the university's mask mandate policy, and his season tickets were suspended because he was not following that protocol. The Spokesman Review interviewed him to ask him about it, and he confirmed that was the case, and that he felt he was singled out because he's such a high profile person. And then, you know, he said some things about COVID that shows that he, you know, kind of is not really following the science. He repeated an unfounded claim that 100 to 150 professional athletes have died from the vaccine, which is not true.
What?
And so, you know, just kind of an interesting thing. I don't know if they'll work their, you know, their dispute out or not. But it was certainly caught a lot of people's attention that he was suspended. His season tickets were suspended.
Well, the rules apply to everyone in that situation. I do want to talk about some breaking news very quickly before we go to break, because the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, as well as Central District Health, have just announced the first confirmed infection with the BA.2 subvariant of the Omicron variant in Ada County. Now, this subvariant has been identified so far in 22 states and at least 40 countries. Here's what we know so far about this. This is according to a report from National Public Radio that came out just yesterday on this. Scientists are saying that it's not the weaker sibling. They're saying it's very similar to the current Omicron variant, which is BA.1. So it's strong. It's possibly more contagious than the current Omicron variant. It is making surges last longer in places like Denmark and in England and in Germany. However, scientists are also saying at least preliminary data is showing that if you are fully vaccinated, your risk of hospitalization, of death, are still low against this newest subvariant. So, of course, keep listening to NPR throughout the day, throughout the weekend. They will have more about this. I know we will talk more about it on Wednesday with our medical experts, but that's what we know at this point about this new subvariant. We do have one confirmed case in Ada County. Okay, we need to talk about the legislature. Kevin, an uphill battle for higher ed is in front of them, many of these institutions. Can we start with what happened at the Statehouse and JFAC this morning with the University of Idaho? Some fireworks going on there.
Well, a continuation of what we were hearing all week. So the college and university presidents all had their turn going before the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee this week. And as you might expect, the topic of critical race theory, social justice spending came up, partly because Ron Nate, a Republican from Rexburg, was asking all of the university presidents to outline what did they do in the past year to respond to the budget cuts that the legislature imposed last year. How did they cut? Did they cut programs? Did they cut what he called wasteful social justice programs? Well, Scott Green, president of the University of Idaho, was having none of it today. He was very forceful and said, we had an independent report done by Holly Troxell, the Boise law firm, that looked at the allegations of any systemic indoctrination on campus, really responding directly to a report from the Idaho Freedom Foundation. Holly Troxell found no evidence of any wrongdoing. Green came armed with that report, and he came out swinging, not just at Representative Nate. He was fairly pointed in his responses to Nate, but he was fairly pointed. He didn't mention the Freedom Foundation by name, but he talked about what he called, I'm calling up the quote now to get it right, conflict entrepreneurs who are making their living basically sowing discord and distrust and fear amongst legislators and voters. I mean, it was a pretty forceful takedown and a pretty forceful response. It was very interesting to watch how the various university presidents responded to those questions. Marlene Trump from Boise State, Nate asked her on three occasions, well, what did you cut? What did you cut? What did you cut? And Trump didn't really ever answer what they cut, but said that they kind of recalibrated, you know, revamped some of their programs, but tried to keep the programs in place to satisfy satisfy what the legislature wanted, but also continue to provide services to students. Kevin Satterley from Idaho State said, well, here's what we did. We looked at all of our diversity programs and we wanted to make sure that they're being funded through voluntary user fees, not from the state's budget and not from mandatory student fees. So very different responses from the three presidents, but Scott Green, definitely the most forceful of the three.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, Kevin, I believe that during this presentation, he said, we will give you an unredacted copy of this independent review.
I got mine this morning. I'm going through reading it right now.
Right. And And again, I mean, he went on to say, and this is a quote, "I was confident there was no indoctrination or affirmation program at the University of Idaho." He went on to say, "And while I was confident of that, certain conflict entrepreneurs and those who are earning their living by scaring people with such illusions have made these claims, which surfaced
and another thing, Gemma, that I thought was interesting in the report and in the exchange between Representative Nate and President Green, Representative Nate pointed to a diversity position that's been created in the College of Engineering. He cited that as an example that U of I is not backing off of social justice programs. Well, President Green, and he was quoting directly out of the Holly Troxler report, said, wait a minute, this was funded and this was an endowed position and it was funded by Micron Technology. They wanted this position and they were very clear. Micron gave the U of I the money for this position with the idea that it would be a position focused on diversity topics. And the report said, Micron sees value in this and sees value in this education for engineering mm-hmm. students who may eventually wind up working at Micron.
Right. I think it's fascinating. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
And I think that's, you know, a really important point, because if you look at the questioning from Ron Nate, Representative Ron Nate, you know, he's really kind of conflating critical race theory with any whiff of diversity or equity or inclusion programs. Mm-hmm. And like Kevin said, a lot of these diversity programs and, you know, the result of the task force, the indoctrination task force, really couldn't even define what they were looking for with critical race theory. And so you kind of see that playing out now where the legislators are going after anything that seeks to diversify and be inclusionary in higher education. And a lot of these programs, and not just that Micron-funded program, but there are several programs that Representative Nate cited with Marlene Trump on Tuesday, that are actually funded by other companies, Boise Cascade and KeyBank, because not only the higher education has an interest in diversifying their ranks, but companies want diversity in their ranks, and they want graduates, they want our institutions of higher education to graduate students who are diverse and come from different backgrounds and races and genders. And so this is not just a woke culture. This is actually something that is a business imperative for a lot of businesses in Idaho.
And Gemma, to give you a sense, you know, I think the college and university presidents are really kind of struggling to figure out how to respond to what they're hearing from their campus communities. You know, Cynthia Pemberton's the president of Lewis Clark State College. She was asked about the issue on Tuesday, and she said, "We're looking into every complaint." And I'll give you a case in point. I heard a complaint last year from somebody who thought there was a course that was condoning cannibalism. Yes, we talked about cannibalism in JFAC this week. Mm. She said that she had heard this complaint, she looked into it, and came to find out that it was an anthropology course that was talking about, you know, tribal nations that have practiced cannibalism in the past and was in no way condoning or advocating cannibalism. So, you know, sigh of relief, everybody. Lewis Clark is not pro-cannibalism. But that gives you a sense of where this is going and how you know, colleges and universities are just trying to respond to this, these allegations, these concerns, these criticisms, and trying to get a handle on what people are talking about.
Well, and also when we talk about, you know, diversity and inclusion, and I think, Scott, you brought up a good point, is that let's look at this across the board. Diversity and inclusion also means women. And when you look at STEM programs, which that is what the College of Engineering is at the University of Idaho, if you analyze 10 years of institutional data, it will show you that more women drop out of STEM majors with higher GPAs than men who drop out, significantly higher GPAs. Women drop out usually with a B average GPA. Men who drop out of STEM, it's at about a C minus to a D. These women who drop out of STEM majors have GPAs that are indistinguishable from the GPAs of men. So that also goes back to the idea of diversity and inclusion. And I don't know if that's being talked about.
Right, right. And I think where the rubber is going to meet the road is obviously when this comes to the House floor, who's going to pick side? What sides are people going to pick? You know, you expect this from, you know, Representative Ron Maid and Priscilla Giddings and Heather Scott and Dorothy Moon, and you expect it from a certain contingent of the House of Representatives. But last year, there were a number of legislators, Republican legislators, who voted against the higher education budget that you might not expect to vote against the higher education budget based on these kinds of allegations. And so I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether those legislators, that group of reasonable Republicans, will side with Ron Maid, or will they side with, you know, the entire business community in Idaho.
And at the same time, Gemma, and I'll do this really quickly, you know, there are some really serious policy questions that this budget raises. I mean, the governor is talking about giving higher education what could be its biggest dollar for dollar increase in state history. But even with that, he's not fully funding a 5% pay raise for employees out of that general fund. He's expecting that part of that money would come from student fees and tuition. So even though he's made a, you know, what could be a historic request for higher education funding, and even though we've got this surplus like we've never seen in state history, there's a good chance that college students and their parents will be paying higher tuition because the colleges and universities are going to try to award this 5% pay raise that the governor has recommended. And the presidents are saying, look, we really want to do this. We are losing employees. We're having a hard time recruiting employees. We've got to pay our employees more, but it means we may have to charge more for students to attend the universities.
Right. And then you wonder why, Kevin, we see, you know, high school graduation rates drop, right? We see
that very question came up in committee this week. You know, or why are we passing this cost on to students when we are also expecting those same students to go on to college? It's a very complicated and interesting policy and budget question.
Especially when you're sitting on an almost $2 billion surplus.
Yeah.
We need to also talk about the redistricting woes that are going on. So, Rebecca, tell us about this, because this is, and we've talked about this numerous times here in Idaho Matters, every 10 years, because of the census, you have to look at redistricting, and you so sometimes your legislative districts get redrawn. That's happened in Idaho. But wow, there's been all kinds of issues around this.
Right. So another thing that tends to happen every 10 years is people sue over the new redistricting map. So that's the case here. There have been 5 lawsuits filed. 4 were saying that the map redrawing the 35 legislative districts were improperly drawn because it split too many counties or didn't keep certain communities of interest together. The other one is about the congressional district map. So the Idaho Supreme Court this week rejected those 4 lawsuits that targeted the legislative district map. The Supreme Court said that the 4 groups that were suing failed to show that the way the Idaho Commission for Reapportionment split up some counties was unreasonable. So in other words, the high court said, look, we're not gonna go in and say how we would have done it, or we're just gonna look at whether what they did was reasonable. And what they did appears to be reasonable. Justice John Stegner wrote the unanimous decision. And he said, basically, it's a really tough job to follow the federal rules that say, you know, one person, one vote. You can't have one district that's a lot bigger than the others, because then the people in that district, their votes sort of just diluted. So you have to balance that with what the Idaho Constitution says, which is you can't sort of just split up counties willy-nilly, right? You have to try not to split up counties as much as you can within reason. So a bunch of the people that sued, one of them was Brandon Durst, a former lawmaker running for office again. He said that he drew a map that only split up 7 counties. And the commission's map split up 8. And so he said that shows that you can actually split up fewer counties. Therefore, it's, you know, doesn't meet the requirements under Idaho's laws. And that's what a few of the other people who sued said as well. But what the high court said was, well, you know, the commission appeared to also be balancing these other issues, like we did, you know, trying to keep trying to make sure that there's the same number of people in each district. And in fact, they did that pretty much more, like they got more even than previous commissions had ever managed. They had a variance of around 5%. The Coeur d'Alene tribe and the Shoshone-Bannock tribes also sued. And they sued because of the way their reservations, their respective reservations were split up. They made the argument that, like, you know, if anyone's a community of interest in Idaho, it's the tribes. You know, they predated the state. They've been acting as a community. They should be able to have that unity in how their voice is used in elections. But Judge Stegner, or Justice Stegner, rather, acknowledged their argument, said, you know, I hear you. But the high court said, the Constitution, the state Constitution, doesn't mention tribal community interest as like something getting extra protection above keeping counties together. So in other words, to give the tribes the heightened sort of protective status they seek when it comes to redistricting, there would have to be an amendment to the state Constitution made.
Okay, so at this point, they have to move forward with this new plan.
Yes. So it appears that the legislative district map seems to be what the commission drew is what it's going to be. Now the congressional map, there were arguments in that last week. That ruling has not yet come out. So there was just one lawsuit targeting the congressional map. That was from a gentleman who said that it split up voting precincts incorrectly. The state and the attorneys for the state, the Council on Redistricting or Commission on Redistricting, responded and said, you know, voting precincts get changed up all the time by county commissioners. They're basically a tool of convenience for aiding voting. The redistricting commission drew a good map. And yes, some precincts got split up, all in Ada County, but Ada County said they were going to redraw those precincts anyway. So they said, you know, that's an acceptable thing to do. So we'll wait and see what the high court says about that.
Audrey, I want to go back to the pandemic for a moment, because when we look back on the last 2 years, for all intents and purposes, the state of Idaho has remained basically open. But then Omicron hit. And have we seen changes because of that?
Yeah, having the supply shortage, supply chain issues, pharmacies having reduced hours, healthcare is impacted, you know, clinics have had to reduce their hours. Retail's been hit hard. And it's sort of like the whole adage of virus gonna virus. I've heard that a lot from folks who have minimized the pandemic. But if a virus is uncontrolled, it's gonna take people out of work. It's kind of how it,
right.
That's what happens. And we've got an extremely, extremely contagious variant circulating right now. So I talked with Alex LeBeau from the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry about it. And he pointed out, you know, Idaho employers were having a hard time filling jobs before this surge. That's true of but, you know, many, many places around the country, not just Idaho, but we've had it particularly hard here because of the many different factors that are involved with that, housing prices and wages and things like that. But, you know, he said Idaho employers went into 2022 with a tremendous amount of unfilled jobs. And this is a quote: where we find ourselves as employers is that situation where we're already running thin because we had a lot of job openings. Then Omicron comes up and takes a swipe. And sure enough, a bunch of people are at home now, including me, because he was at home with his son in isolation, man, because they had COVID-19. They were doing well, which he attributed to being fully vaccinated. But I mean, the reality is that if you allow a virus to spread unchecked, which many people in Idaho are doing, then it's going to affect the economy. And that's been one of the most interesting things throughout the pandemic is seeing, you know, leaders talking about the economy and business and how important it is to make sure people can keep their jobs. Well, what now? I mean, if it affects businesses this greatly. I mean, we've had reports of restaurants having to close temporarily, businesses having to close temporarily. They don't have the staff or mm-hmm. the, you know, they're all quarantined or for whatever reason. But I mean, this is an effect on business and an effect on our economy.
Right. I mean, one example is I had to get a prescription filled yesterday. And the pharmacy, they were lovely, but they said, could you give us extra time? We have two people working today. I mean,
yeah,
that's...
pharmacies have been slammed. I mean, they're doing tests, they're doing vaccines, they're going to be giving out masks, and they're dealing with the exact same stuff that any other business is dealing with. With, you know, you go out and you exist in the community, right? So right. If the folks around you are not taking precautions, you are more likely to get infected. You are more likely to have to call in sick to work because you don't feel good. We've made this so much about death and even hospitalizations, but it's also like, we've never had a bug that's this contagious ever. Right. Measles is not this contagious because of the multiplication factor. So like, this is what happens.
Well, yeah, this is what happens when you make the choices that you make. With that said, Scott, I want to move on to this homeless encampment that's been set up on the grounds of the old Ada County Courthouse. For folks who aren't familiar, that's in downtown Boise between 5th and 6th Street. Because first off, Scott, tell us why this was set up, but then there could be some big issues coming this weekend.
Yeah, and it's a potentially dangerous situation, but this is a homeless encampment, kind of a mini tent city set up as a protest to protest the conditions that are leading to a homelessness crisis in Boise. There are tents set up and there are people there, and the people who are protesting are indeed homeless themselves. And the concern is that there's a group on Facebook called Idaho Liberty Dogs, which is behind, a couple of past counter protests when we had the Boise Black Lives Matter and Defund the Police rallies last year. These folks showed up to counter protest, leading to some minor violence that was fortunately stemmed before it got out of hand. Well, they have vowed to show up to protest this tent city on Saturday at 1 o'clock. And they, on their Facebook page, they say this is a peaceful protest. However, some of the people who follow them have made comments, and I'll quote a couple of them. Organize 200, 300 folks with ARs to clean up. How about flamethrowers? I'm in, got a truck and trailer to haul away the trash. I heard baseball bats clean things up real nice at like 2 a.m. It has a real potential to get out of hand. And hopefully, police respond in kind to the situation and can head off any sort of violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kevin, Ruby Creek is a very popular half marathon in Idaho. In fact, I mean, a lot of running enthusiasts, running experts say it's one of the toughest half marathons in the United States. It happens every April. And there is some backlash going on because of a decision that organizers made for this year's race.
Well, there sure is backlash. And it kind of goes back to what Audrey was talking about before, about how the pandemic is changing everybody's lives. So full disclosure here, I've run Roby 7 times, either in person or virtually, because I'm a slow learner.
I've done it once, Kevin. That was more than enough. Yeah, one time.
You're a lot quicker on the uptake than I am. I've done it 7 times. But so... what the organizers came up with last week was a set of guidelines to go back to a real live in-person race for the first time in 3 years. They want to put on an in-person race in April. And they've come up with a lot of procedures and protocols that are not unique to races. These have been done at other big races before. They're talking about not having spectators at the finish line. They're talking about staggered starts so that you'll have 2,000 people all gathered together starting the race at the same time. So you have smaller groups running in waves. And the biggest policy that they've come up with is that they're going to require vaccinations for everybody who runs the race. And there's been a lot of backlash about it. I mean, it proves, runners, we get a lot of we get a lot of grief for talking too much about running. Well, it turns out that runners also like to talk a lot about vaccinations and the pros and cons of vaccinations. And the organizers have taken a pretty big backlash over their decision. What'll be interesting to see is whether it affects the turnout. You know, 3 years out, I think there's probably still a lot of pent up desire to get back out there and run a real race. This is a race that sells out pretty quickly, historically. I can't imagine that's going to change all that much, even with the vaccination requirement, but we'll see. President's Day is the registration date, so we'll see what kind of response people have.
Well, and you make a good point, Kevin. I mean, you're right. I mean, historically, like that, the registration opens up, and if it, I mean, it sells out within hours.
15 minutes most years. It's really, really fast. So it'll be interesting to see what happens at noon on President's Day when they open up the registration as usual.
Yeah, I think it will be interesting to see what happens with that. I know, Kevin, we touched on this very briefly earlier in the program, but can we talk a little bit more about the fact that we saw a dip once again in high school graduation rates?
Yeah, and the numbers get kind of interesting, but as you might have expected during the pandemic, we saw a decrease in the graduation rate from involving the class of 2021, the kids who were due to graduate in the spring of 2021. The grad rate dropped from 82% in 2020 to about 80% in 2021. And again, with everything that happened in the pandemic, I don't think that can be terribly surprising. State Superintendent Cherry Barra is trying to look at the numbers a little bit differently, and she's taking consolation in the fact that the five-year graduation rate, and here we're talking about how do kids do if you give them an extra year beyond their regularly expected graduation year, if they need more time to finish up their coursework. Do they get there? And what she's pointing to is that the students who were scheduled to graduate in the spring of 2020, you know, right in the heart of the beginning of this pandemic, and you look at what they did through 2021, that five-year graduation rate is actually increasing and has increased over the past few years. So that's the numbers that she's pointing to. We'll see what happens with the class of 2021 and see if if more of those kids graduate a year later, we'll get those numbers next year. There's always kind of a lag because we're looking to see what happens to kids who didn't graduate as scheduled. But yeah, it's a mix of numbers. But really, at the end, I don't think you can be too surprised that the graduation rate dropped, given all of the disruptions in education these past 2 years.
Yeah. Rebecca, what is going on with Representative Priscilla Giddings? Because she is apparently being sued under Idaho's Public Records Act.
Yeah, so Priscilla Giddings, Representative Giddings, is the Islamicer who was censured last year after publicizing the name of the 19-year-old intern who reported being raped by another lawmaker. So the attorney who represented that intern filed a lawsuit earlier this month against Representative Giddings, contending that Giddings didn't comply with the state law when she denied a public records request for documents related to the ethics investigation against Giddings and against former Republican lawmaker Aaron Von Ellinger, who was the person who was accused in that rape case. He resigned from the legislature last year. Also, he has pleaded not guilty. He's facing charges in criminal court. He's maintained that he has committed no wrongs. So we'll see how that trial plays out, I think, in April. However, this public records request, Representative Giddings didn't respond to my request for comments, but she did send out a campaign email to her constituents last week, and she called the case a nuisance lawsuit from the, quote, Boise Swamp. And she said that the requested records don't exist. So she said that she even had the Legislative Services Office search all her files, and they found nothing related to this request from Erica Birch, who's the attorney who's bringing the lawsuit. So there's a couple of things there. Idaho's legislature doesn't really have a retention rule. So it's possible that the records maybe did exist at one point and then got deleted and are no longer there. Or maybe, if Birch is able to prove what she's contending in the lawsuit, maybe they did exist and it just wasn't a good search, or they, her request was wrongfully denied. Birch has said that Representative Giddings didn't cite the law that allowed her to exempt or not turn over those records. And so that could be a component of this lawsuit as well. But we'll have to wait and see. I mean, certainly there's a lot of, it seems like public records lawsuits are coming up increasingly in this state. And so it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out.
Yeah. With our last few minutes before we wrap up today, I want to talk about something that did not necessarily make traditional news headlines, but it was discussed on social media platforms this week. And that is the issue of, in particular, mothers and work and what we have to do to take care of our children and do our jobs during the pandemic. So I, in full disclosure, I'm going to be taking off my host hat for a minute because I am a working mother and I have children. And I bring this up because it was the 27th annual Pundits Forum with the City Club of Boise earlier this week. And Kevin, I know that you were one of the pundits there. Melissa Davlin, our colleague from Idaho Public Television, was also a pundit. She appeared virtually because she has young children, and she has had numerous issues with childcare since this pandemic, as have many of us. And there was apparently someone who made a comment complaining about her being there with her young child.
Yeah, that's pretty much the summary of it. I mean, it was a strange comment and really kind of a ridiculous comment. I was moderating the panel. I did not have a sick toddler in my lap when I was moderating, thank goodness, because I'm not as good at multitasking. You know, Melissa was on one of the panelists, and with a sick toddler in her lap, she did a better job on the panel than I did without a sick toddler in her lap. I mean, it's ridiculous. And if you haven't been paying attention for the past 2 years, this is what's been going on. I mean, this is kind of our Zoom society. I mean, you know, Melissa was on Zoom because, you know, she had, you know, sick kids. I mean, she's been, you know, dealing with illnesses in her household. And, you know, if you find this stuff distracting 2 years into the pandemic, I don't know which pandemic you've been living through. I mean, come on, you know, this is life in 2022. It's been life since 2020, you know, get a grip.
Well, and frankly, Kevin, though, this has been life, and please, Audrey and Rebecca, I would love to hear your thoughts on this. This has been the way of the world for mothers forever. I mean, I think everybody who is a regular listener of Idaho Matters knows my son, Joey. You want to know why? Because I'm a working mom, because there's a pandemic and there is a lack of childcare. And at times there was a lack of school. So this is what we put up with. I think it's brought the veil down of what mothers, and I know there are fathers out there, but what mothers have had to juggle from time and eternity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think anyone who has worked with Melissa Davlin in any forum knows she is a consummate professional. If this person who was complaining because it was distracting, I just think, let's look at how distracting this comment has been. I mean, this blew up over social media. We're talking about it now. I mean, that's kind of silly. And the fact that this is still a problem that falls primarily on working moms as opposed to other working parents, I think should really just raise some questions about the infrastructure we have supporting working families, about the way we just sort of automatically might divide that sort of workload within the house of two working parents. I just find it all kind of infuriating, honestly.
Right. And I have to wrap up, unfortunately, because let me tell you, I could talk about this all day long, but I do think it exposes the issue of childcare, and we need to do better. Thank you to Audrey Dutton, to Rebecca Boone, to Scott McIntosh, and Kevin Richard. Appreciate all of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.